This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon, Denise Perry. According to the history books, the Vietnam War ended in 1973. In January of that year, the U.S. halted offensive operations in North Vietnam, and peace pacts were signed in Paris. In March, U.S. troops withdrew, ending the longest war in U.S. history. But for a significant number of U.S. veterans, the war is not over. An estimated 250,000 combat veterans suffer from what is called post-traumatic stress disorder. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Jonathan Shea, details the experiences of combat vets, telling their stories about what it is like to go to war and survive in a new book titled Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. Achilles in Vietnam relates veterans' stories to the story of the Iliad, Homer's centuries-old epic poem of war, betrayal, and anger. The book is published by Athenaeum. Dr. Jonathan Shea is a psychiatrist for the Boston Department of Veteran Affairs Outpatient Clinic. He is on the faculty of Tufts Medical School and trains staff for the New England Shelter for Homeless Veterans. And we welcome him this afternoon. Dr. Shea, good afternoon and welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And we invite the audience to pick up the phone and join us in the conversation this afternoon. All you need to do is give us a call at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Shea, I want to say, first of all, that the pain of the veterans' stories that you set down in your book is very palpable. And I wonder if maybe the best place to start would be to share with the audience the depth and extent of their experience of post-traumatic stress disorder. And maybe I'd ask you to read a piece from the book, perhaps from the composite voice that you use in the introduction.
Okay. Do you have a specific piece that you had in mind?
I didn't actually mark anything in particular. I was...
Okay. What this is a composite of voices of the veterans in the program, where I'm the psychiatrist. And I'm just going to pick a spot at random to start. And this is the veteran speaking. I don't deserve my wife. What kind of life is it for her married to me? She says, let's take the kids out for dinner. And I say, sure, let's go. So we go to the restaurant and we walk in the door and I say, whoa, when I look around and I see all those people. So the hostess shows us to a table right in the middle, and I say, how about over there in the corner? She says, there's people there. I said, we'll wait. Meantime, my wife is looking at me, and there's sweat running down my face. I can't sit with my back uncovered. If I know you're back there covering me, it's okay. But a bunch of strangers and some of them gooks? No way. I sit in the corner where I can see everyone who comes in and everyone who leaves. So, after we wait 30 minutes for the table in the corner, we start walking through the restaurant to it, and my heart's pounding, and the sweat's rolling off me, and I say, I gotta go. So, they sit down and eat, and I stand up in the parking garage on the second floor overlooking the entrance to the restaurant, where I have a real good line on everything that's going on.
Hmm. There's fear of people.
A real destruction of the capacity to be comfortable in a crowd of strangers, no matter how benign, strangers sitting in a restaurant eating.
Mm-hmm. And a real destruction of trust.
Yes, that's the core. The core injury, in one sense.
Yeah. Part of the title of the book is The Undoing of Character.
Right.
How does this happen, and how quickly does it happen? How long does it last?
The way it happens is to some degree still a mystery, but clearly betrayal of what's right by people in authority is one major way that the capacity for trust is damaged. But the other enormous blows of combat clearly also play a role. But the core of it seems to be a destruction of the capacity for social trust. If you want to call it paranoia, you can, but I don't think we get all that far by using this sort of psychobabble. Now, the consequences of this in the lives of people at their work, in their families, in their public roles as citizens are just beyond measure. For example, it's very hard for a combat soldier to, with PTSD, to show up at a particular time and a particular place repeatedly. In combat, this was death. If you did the same thing over and over again, the enemy was watching, and it led to your death or to the death of people you cared about. Now, this survival skill of being unpredictable is carried into civilian life, and it is viewed by others as irresponsibility, unreliability. What it is the persistence of this way of staying alive into a situation where it's no longer needed. Some people think of this as being a sign of bad character in the veteran. It's not bad character. They're just doing what they learned to stay alive.
Mm-hmm. They learned it. That's really important, I think. And then, is it possible to unlearn it?
To a degree, we don't know. The human brain is really rigged to learn. It's an amazing learning machine. What it's not good at is unlearning things that it has learned in life or death situations. Things that are learned in those situations are so deeply ingrained. But you can see gradual development of new skills to sort of get around those old survival skills that are still there.
Mm.
It's a very slow process and mainly depends on the development of a trustworthy community. That's the core of it. When the veterans get together and are able to support each other and teach each other skills, they make suggestions. Hey, well, if you want to go out with your family, why don't you try this? Like, why don't you try going at a time when the restaurant is empty? You may not be able to go when it's crowded, but at least you'll be able to go with them at some time. And so they find ways of living with these persistent survival skills, even if they can't just say, okay, I'm safe now, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in the idea of Achilles and the Iliad. What are the parallels between the Iliad and the war in Vietnam?
Well, one of the points that I try to make in this book is that war, when you look at it from the heart of the soldier, really hasn't changed in 3,000 years. The technology has changed, the organizations have changed, but the guts of it are the same. And that is that an army, any army, is a moral structure. And if the leadership of that army betrays what's right, this does terrible, terrible damage to the soldier. And in the Iliad, the story opens like with a thunderclap where Achilles' commander, whose name was Agamemnon, betrays what's right by seizing his prize of honor. Now, the Iliad shows so many things that are generic to prolonged combat. Achilles loses his closest friend, who happens to be his foster brother and second in command. And this is so typical of battle, that people become enormously close, and then battle truncates that closeness by the death of one of them. And Achilles suffers tremendous grief, tremendous guilt. He says, it should have been me. He feels like he's already dead himself. How many times have we heard Vietnam veterans say, I died in Vietnam? And then, and this is very painful to contemplate, Achilles goes berserk and commits atrocities against both the living and the dead.
Hmm. So we have a betrayal of a sense of what's right and wrong. We have a small social order. We have a lot of isolation, a tremendous dependency of one soldier on the next. And ultimately, in war, you're going to experience death. And then the horrible rage. Again, we talked about learning and what happens when you learn to stay alive. Do we know about what happens, how this sort of unfolds, what happens as these experiences unfold, that they become so difficult to escape, to recover from?
You mentioned earlier the word isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Isolation is one of the main things that keeps the whole thing going, that keeps the survival skills alive that really need to gradually die down and allow a person to come back into civilian life. So it's re-entering some kind of community, breaking that isolation, that seems to be the most critical thing. In the book, I repeatedly emphasize that communalization of trauma is the key to healing from it, and that much of the healing that happened spontaneously in past wars was interrupted by the policy that they had during the Vietnam War of individual rotations. In World War II, men trained together, they went over together, they fought together, and they came home together, and usually by boat, which was a long, slow process. So that a whole lot of communalization of their trauma was already sort of spontaneously and almost automatically done by the preservation of this social unit. Now, in Vietnam, men trained with men that they then never saw again, and they went over to Vietnam alone with a plane full of strangers. They were assigned by the computer to units that had lost men either through as casualties or because their tour was up. And they were sent out to these highly stressed units where the people there said, I don't want to know you. You're the new guy. Don't tell me where you're from. Don't tell me your name. You're just going to get yourself killed and maybe get me killed. Get away from me. And so they reintegrated themselves as best they could into these highly stressed units. And then at the end of their tour, having integrated themselves and formed some profoundly tight bonds to other people, then they left, and they left alone. And they left, there were guys in my program who were literally from a firefight to the streets of Boston in less than 48 hours. It was like being dropped in from Mars.
And a lot of these men returned to situations where, well, the war was an unpopular war, so they also faced that when they came home.
Men not only experienced public rejection, but many of them experienced rejection from their family,
mm-hmm.
which is painful beyond imagining.
Yeah, there's the story of a recounted in the book of the veteran who is asked by a relative, "So, what was it like?"
And yes, well, this man, in fact, had quite good support from his family, but his family, and this is normal and typical, his family could not hear the truth that he had to bring from the battlefield. Paul Fussell, who's written a number of amazing books on both World War I and World War II, points out that after World War II, men were welcomed back as heroes, but nobody wanted to hear the bad news that they brought from the battlefield any more than they did after Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. You know, it strikes me that we just marked the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and for the first time from a lot of veterans from World War II, we're hearing about how horrific it was.
They're realizing that their own death is approaching very rapidly, and that they've never told a soul. And some of them are deciding, yes, it's time to speak.
Mm. And back to Paul Fussell. In the introduction, you use him from quoting him from a book that he's written called "The Great War in Modern Memory."
Yes, a classic.
Yeah, and I'll quote this: "What listener wants to be torn and shaken when he doesn't have to be? We have made unspeakable mean indescribable. It really means nasty." What does it mean to not be able to tell your story?
It means that you're sitting there alone with it. It means that you begin to feel like a complete freak. You think that there is nobody that can understand what you went through. You begin to feel that nobody is like you. Sometimes this can take on a grandiose tinge where the person experiences this as some sort of specialness that often can be very, can even become antisocial. But the core of it is the sense of being all alone with this experience. Now, this is true of all survivors of very horrible trauma. It was true of the concentration camp survivors. It's true of incest survivors. It's true of survivors of political torture. They feel that there is no one who will understand what they went through. Now, there's one key exception for all such groups, and that is that there is the expectation that other people who went through similar things, that they will understand. And so you find the natural sense of community that combat veterans have with each other, that concentration camp survivors had with each other. Some of them are still alive, so they still do.
Mm-hmm.
But that very sort of obvious thing is a crucially important doorway that people have to begin a process of healing. It's to find other people who went through the same thing.
Hmm. I was surprised to learn, though, that survivors of trauma may deny the validity of another survivor's experience. And vets, as you point out in the book, refer to this as a pissing contest.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that happen?
Oh, I wish I knew. It seems almost universal, and it makes me mad. Because any time I encounter one survivor denying the validity of what someone of someone else's pain and claiming that only their pain alone is significant, there's no need for that. No person's pain can be measured against any other's. Each person's is his or her own, and to create divisions among people who have suffered in this terrible way, it just serves the purposes of people who want us to go on doing things the way we've done them for thousands of years.
Consciously?
I doubt that. That's the consequence of
uh-huh.
it. But I strongly advocate with the men that I work with that they realize that we're all in this together and that there is an enormous commonality between themselves and battered women. And occasionally, this is not something that people can hear in the early stages of recovery, but often they can hear it when they have accomplished a good bit of recovery and are able to expand their moral and social horizon to include other people than people who are just like themselves.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that we have Achilles, and then we have the story of these veterans. And it seems that ultimately telling a story is essential to what it is to be human. We have epic poems. We have oral histories. We have novels. Telling stories is really important. But what happens to, we talked about what happens to individuals, veterans, who maybe are, who keep the story to themselves or can't tell it. But what happens to a nation when it chooses not to listen, to shut out the possibility of what Paul Fussell talked about being torn and shaken?
Well, we end up with some very poisonous myths about ourselves. We end up with the idea that we alone are uniquely pure in our our motives, in what we're trying to do. We end up with the poisonous myth that we alone only do good, and that because we are so well-intended that the consequences of what we do is always good. And this led us down the road to this horrible bloodletting and bleeding of the spirit that took place in Vietnam. I think we need to hear the voices of the Vietnam vet because we need to hear it, not as something that we need to do for them. This is something we need to do for ourselves.
Because we can be just as isolated.
Indeed, we can be isolated in this myth of American exceptionalism where we carry some sort of divinely appointed mission in the world that means that we don't have to pay attention to other people or what they are trying to do for themselves.
Hmm. We've talked about isolation, and we've talked about how the war itself sort of fostered isolation in terms of the way individuals were rotated in and out of units. Another interesting thing that I was unaware of but also speaks to isolation is that the command function was isolated. You have a ground, you have a unit on the ground, and their commander may be in the air, and his commander above him, and on and on. Would you talk a little bit about how the command function worked or didn't work in Vietnam?
Well, there were a number of catastrophic technological and institutional factors that converged in Vietnam. First of all, Vietnam was the first war that was actually fought with helicopters, and it became possible for a higher commander to be present in heavy ironic quotes on the battlefield by orbiting in a helicopter 2,000, 4,000, 6,000 feet above the battlefield and attempting to micromanage the battle by radio. The veterans speak with great scorn of the great leader in the sky. There is a profound difference between being on the ground and being out of range of gunfire in the air. The second really catastrophic thing was an institutional thing. It came to be known as ticket punching. The commanders at the company level and above, the combat commanders at company level and above, were rotated in and out of combat every 6 months. And the alleged purpose of this was, quote, fairness, meaning being fair in offering junior officers opportunity to advance within the military. Now, what was fairness in a careerist sense to the officers was the most lethal kind of unfairness to the men under their command. Because if anyone has got to know the habits of the enemy, the terrain, the weather, the capacities of one's own troops and one's own arms, who to trust for information among the junior officers and seasoned non-commissioned officers, who to go to hear what the real truth is as to what's going on. If anyone has got to know that, it's the commanders at the company and battalion level. And if they were rotated in and out every 6 months, they never got a chance to learn their job. The critical skills in combat, leadership, probably can only be learned on the job. And the American soldier was placed at a brutal disadvantage relative to the enemy that he was fighting, who kept their commanders in the field in the same place literally for years. So when the Americans, for instance, many people in the audience probably saw the TV special on the Battle of the I Drang or read General Moore's and Galloway's excellent book called We Were Soldiers Once and Young. Mm-hmm. When the air cavalry was dropped into the I Drang, they were up against commanders who had been in that area for a very long time and knew every wrinkle of the Earth's surface in their area of operation. And the difference that makes, knowing the weather. I mean, the enemy made incredible use of the weather during the siege of Khe Sanh, which was part of why that siege was such a brutal thing for the Marines who were stuck in there.
And the men who were commanders, combat commanders, who realized what it was and to leave and have a green commanding officer come in who didn't want to leave. They were thought to be a little off the...
They were said to have, quote, gone native.
Yeah.
Gone native meant that not that they had gone over to the enemy, but that they had gone over to the men for whom they were, whose lives they were responsible for, that they ceased to care more about the institutional reward system than they did about the lives of the men under them. In the most horrible perversions that and organizational pathologies involved the way numbers and statistics were used, so that there were even situations where commanders were regarded as not aggressive enough when the casualties in their own units were lower than the statistical average for other units. This was taken as a sign of failure, which is so grotesque because, for example, in World War II, Patton, who was among the most aggressive and effective combat leaders, had very low casualty rates in his in the forces under his command. Compared to any other comparable unit, he had very low casualty rates. Nobody would have dreamt of assessing him as insufficiently motivated or insufficiently aggressive because his casualties were lower, whereas in Vietnam they actually, and this is documented, this isn't folklore, that there were incentive structures set up that in effect rewarded people for having higher levels of casualties. We're not talking here just about body counts, which had their own perverse outcomes. I'm talking about actual American casualties being regarded as a sign of the effectiveness of the leader. Oh, it gives me a shiver.
Yeah. One of the other things that really disturbs me is the range of betrayal from something as serious as putting inexperienced leaders on the ground in combat situation to the case of the men who were going along and hadn't, they were looking for water, they didn't have water to drink, and so they finally got action in terms of they command dropped cases of tab into this group. They injured somebody as they were doing it. And then, do you recall the story I'm relating here?
I do indeed.
And one of these guys who was involved in the operation of dropping the pop put himself in for a medal.
And got it. Yes. There was tremendous metal inflation in Vietnam, where metals ceased to have any meaning because they were handed out basically frivolously.
Mm.
It's very ancient wisdom of military leadership, going back to Sun Tzu, the Chinese military philosopher who talks of justice in rewards and punishments as being one of the essential virtues of military leadership.
And then there was the story of civilians being killed accidentally, and the word from on high was, it's okay, it happens, and we got body count.
Yes, there. One of the amazing men that I've had the privilege of working with is a man who did four combat tours as an airborne sergeant, and his first combat action, or so they thought, was an attack on that was based on an intelligence error. They were told that these were Viet Cong offloading weapons from sandpans pulled up on the beach. And so in the very early morning before dawn, they came down and got themselves online and then opened up on these boats. And then when the sun came up, they found that there were no weapons, that these were civilian fishermen and their whole families, and that they had just wiped out a whole bunch of unarmed civilians. Now, indeed, in war, terrible errors do happen, but the error is not what left this man feeling betrayed. Mm-hmm. It's that the officers, from the colonel on down, got medals for this action, and where these dead civilians were counted as dead enemies. And now, technically, the combat infantry badge was awarded for simply being in the combat zone in a combat role for 30 days, but this man understood that he and the rest of the men in his unit were given their combat infantry badge, so to speak, to mark their first battle. Now, he felt totally betrayed by this, because the combat infantry badge is the one most highly prized decoration that soldiers... I mean, this has an aura that is of a different quality than the awards like the Bronze Star or the Silver Star, which are for individual valor, but which men came to see as being so highly politicized and subject to luck and peculiar circumstances. But the CIB still has that aura, and this man felt so dishonored to be receiving the CIB for killing unarmed civilians that he says that he wants that day, which was the day before Christmas, just obliterated from the calendar because of his sense of dishonor.
How was it that men signed up for more than one tour of duty?
Well, a combination. Often... it was loyalty to the men who were still there. Since everyone's tour ended at a different time, for your own tour to end automatically meant that you were, as they felt it, abandoning their friends and not staying there to protect them. So protectiveness and loyalty to their comrades was a very frequent motive for re-upping. But another major motive, which is related but in a sinister way, is revenge. When someone's closest friend had been killed, the hunger, the lust for blood, for destruction, for revenge, was often a motive that led them to sign up to volunteer for another tour. This usually people got a 1 month leave in between tours. The airborne sergeant that I mentioned, in fact, was so sunk in the hunger for revenge for the death of his closest friend that he not only re-upped, but he refused to take his leave, and in the four tours that he was there, he never took a leave. He just was so totally locked into this hunger for revenge.
That hunger for revenge, that rage. Here's a guy who wouldn't even take a leave. How long does that emotion continue?
It can continue for a very long time. I refer to that mental state as the berserk state.
Mm-hmm.
Since very typically the berserk state leads to the death of the soldier himself in battle, since the berserk warrior no longer is the least bit concerned about self-protection, they throw off their helmet, they throw off their flak jacket, they do things like standing up in ambushes and doing things that really are extraordinarily dangerous, that this loss of concern for one's own personal safety, which is a mark of the berserk state, usually leads to the death or totally disabling injury of the berserker. Now, because war is such a world of luck and chance, there are always some few who come through uninjured or with minor injuries that they can just carry on with. And, of course, these are the men that I see, the ones who've survived this. The ones who didn't survive it, of course, I never see. And the painful truth for us and for them is that once one has been berserk, this can come back. This leaves a permanent mark in, I believe, in brain physiology. That capacity for instant rage and for a kind of blind rage, remains there. And because these men do not want to hurt other people, do not want to hurt their family, many of them withdraw totally from life. These are men who are out in the forests of the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, out in the forests of the Big Island in Hawaii, or the forests of Northern California, or of Maine. Many of these men have isolated themselves because they are trying to protect other people. They don't want to go into this berserk state. It's not that they say, oh, how wonderful, who can I kill today? These are not people whose moral sense has been destroyed. It persists in the face, their moral sense persists in the face of these gigantic, virtually physiological storms of passion.
Yeah. I have to apologize for this because we're almost out of time, and I want to ask you a big question here at the end. You argue for hating war and honoring the soldier, and we only have about a minute or two left tops. How could we develop armed forces that hate war, and how could we better serve our soldiers?
This paradox, it's no less a paradox in me personally than just sort of intellectually to hate the social institution of war while respecting the soldier and his work. To me, this leads really in one direction, and that is that we must develop and support trustworthy structures of collective security. I know that there is great mistrust in the United States for the United Nations, the feeling that it's a laughingstock, and so on and so forth. But we must work to strengthen some systems of collective security that will allow us gradually over decades, generations, even centuries, to end the social institution of war, which is so pervasively destructive of of human flourishing. And while that goes on, we have to do everything we can to protect the soul of the men and women who we continue to send to do this necessary soldiering work of collective security. We have to care how our soldiers are trained, how they're equipped, how they're led, and how they're brought home. And to care about that, not just when there's a war on, but all the time. And to work together to bring war itself to an end. To do it rationally, to do it in cooperation with other countries, in collective security.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure. I hope the reason nobody's called is that I've said what they thought I needed to say, but anyway, it's been a pleasure being here.
I think sometimes we have a guest such as yourself who is so eloquent that people hate to interrupt.
Well, you're very kind.
Our guest this afternoon has been Jonathan Shea. He's the author of Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. It's published by Athenium. Look for it. It's an excellent book. That's where we leave this part of the show this afternoon. Again, our thanks to Jonathan Shea.